Hello, everyone. Today's talk is with Janet Bompas from Amsterdam. You're based in Amsterdam. You're program director at Scale Up Nation. What do you do there at Scale Up Nation, and what is Scale Up Nation?
So Scale Up Nation is a program where we work with both corporate entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs who are at that phase where they're looking to scale. And so we've got all sorts of different programs and support to help them out.
All right. So you're right on topic, because that is the topic, right? When and how to scale.
That's what we do.
Anything else you want to add, your background or anything?
Sure.
Yeah.
So originally I'm from San Francisco. This is not a Dutch accent. And I worked in Silicon Valley for many years for three different startups. One went public. One was acquired by eBay, PayPal back when they were together. And one completely crashed and burned. So I kind of got the full spectrum of experiences. And if you see me flinch during the our conversation, it's probably scars left over from that one that crashed and burned. But I've now been living in Europe for about 2.5 years, helping big companies move faster and innovate faster like a startup. So it's been a super interesting experience today.
Okay. So that kind of... It's a little bit about what I do today as well. I try and work with large companies, mainly based here in Sweden, Stockholm. That's where I have my office, and help them get better at innovation, build their innovation engine, everything from strategy to operations. And my own background is this. I was an entrepreneur, built a few companies, sold a few companies, and then I spent about 8 years helping other teams take their ideas to market, both as a coach, mentor, and in some cases as a business angel. I would say a failed business angel, because I didn't manage to pinpoint any unicorns, if you would call that.
The odds are not, they're tough.
Not really, no. So that's what I'm doing today. I switched from startups and running my own companies to helping large corporations.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But this scaling part then is interesting to me, because I usually work up until product market fit, up until they're ready to scale.
Yeah.
And that's when I sort of kiss them goodbye. So what about
that's when
this,
I go on my first date with them.
Yes, exactly. So what about scaling? Because on the one hand, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with the Startup Genome Project. They identified the number one reason why startups fail, and they said that is because they scale too early. So
yes.
What would you say? How do you know when you're ready to scale?
Yeah. So that Startup Genome Project that you reference is super interesting. So it was researchers from Stanford and Berkeley and Steve Blank analyzed 3,200 startups. And they found, just as you mentioned, like the high growth internet startups, a whole bunch of them, the majority of them fail to this premature scaling, which is they scale their team, or they start like trying to do customer acquisition, or they overbuild their product in anticipation of demand. And that's why they fail due to that. And I would argue the same thing is true for corporate entrepreneurs. So I have a slide that I use in one of my decks, one of my favorite slides, and it's a picture of an amusement park carnival ride with a sign out front that says, "You must be this tall to ride." it's our kind of our requirements that I have before working with companies, because you don't want to scale before you're ready. It's super difficult in the moment to know, right? It's not easy. You're getting these kind of noisy signals from the market. So I have 6 criteria that I use, and it's not black and white, because again, this is a complex situation, which is hard to see in the moment. But the 6 criteria that I use before I'll start working with someone, a company, is that, one, they've got to have product market fit. You know, they have to have clearly identified paying customers, and the product has to be receiving some, you know, they've got to be delighting customers, right? And the metric I use to see whether or not they're delighting customers is 2 things. One, I look at Sean Ellis. He was the first marketeer at Dropbox. And he actually coined the term growth hacking. And he had a question he would ask. He says, "How would you feel if you could no longer use this product?" And if more than 60% of the people said, "I would be extremely unsatisfied or unsatisfied," that's an indication that you have product market fit. So I'll give you an example. I was working with Philips a couple years ago, a year or so ago, and they had a new product called the One Blade. And so we're doing all these lean startup experiments in the market to see if they're ready to scale. And we would ask them this question, like, if we told you that we're canceling this program and you have to give us back this product, these were beta testers, how upset would you be? And we got more than 90% saying, I would be extremely upset, or, you know, very upset, which is a great indication. So we kind of knew we had it then, and we started then scaling process. And they sold last year, I believe they sold about 1 million pieces, which is significant to the company. So it worked really well. Another really big company I've been working with is this, you know, they've got an initiative. They've been working on it for about a year now. They've got maybe like 30, 40 customers, and they're getting an NPS score of around 6 or 7. And when I sit with them, I'm like, well, you're not ready to scale. Cause like that's, the customers are kind of saying, meh, okay, right? We need to have an NPS score of 9. You've got to have customers who are so excited about your product, cause to get someone to try a new product, it's not easy. So those are kind of the indications I look for a product market fit. So I'm wondering on your side, what do you see for, do you ever look at product market fit?
Absolutely. It's core to what we're doing. And I totally agree with you on the Sean Ellis thing and Net Promoter Score product market fit surveys. And we see them as indicators. It's not like we take it as written in stone. It has to have that score or not. But they're good guides. But we also like to look at the funnel metrics. We tend to kind of focus in on retention and referral first, which is, of course, connected to Net Promoter Score. Rather than throwing a lot of money at the beginning of the funnel where you're doing acquisition and activation, there's no point really if you can't see that you have at least an indication of what lifetime value could be for the customer compared to where the customer acquisition cost is up in the beginning of the funnel.
So yeah, if you have a leaky bucket, there's no use pouring water.
That kind of thing, right? And then, again, bringing up examples like Dropbox, I mean, they had a customer acquisition cost of about $250 when they were doing Google AdWords. And then they changed their referral model with an explainer video, and they did other experiments, and they managed to grow through their loyal users.
Yeah.
But I think everything starts and ends with a great product and a great product experience. But we need to have different ways of measuring it. So product market fit could be one, Net Promoter Score another one, looking at the funnel metrics.
I would agree. Funnel metrics is a good one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So of the 6 criteria to be tall enough to ride, that's probably the biggest one, is that you have product market.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, please.
The second one I say is you have to have kind of a strategic fit for the corporate that you're working with. And that includes not just alignment, but like relevance. Like, are you in a large and growing and profitable market, something that's interesting enough? Mm-hmm. So an example for like the alignment, I was working with a team that was a great, great team, right? And they won this innovation competition in the company. They came into an internal accelerator and they were working on, it was a bank. And so they were working on a product that would be for small, medium entrepreneurs in Africa. And it was a great feel good story. Like, everybody in the bank loved it. And they were a great team. They pivoted, they did their lean startup experiments. And then I didn't see him for about a year afterwards. And I ran into him and I was like, how's it going? Right. And they're like, oh, we quit. And I asked him, like, well, why did you quit? And they were like, well, you know, it turned out this bank's business was pretty much all entirely in Europe. And they actually didn't even really do business in Africa. It's just through some franchise partnerships. And so there never was like a VP who was willing to put their weight behind it and say, no, we're doing this. Like, this is the direction the company needs to go in. And so they could never get the support to grow it. It not only needs to be aligned with a company, but it needs to be growing really kind of in a growing large market that's interesting. So in the Netherlands last year, we actually did some research. And we surveyed 114 entrepreneurs that were having scaling businesses, which, on a side note, by the way, to get 114 entrepreneurs to fill out a 30-minute survey is not easy.
30 minutes.
Well, I know.
That's why we have the Net Promoter Score and the product market fit there, like one question.
I know. Yeah.
30 minutes.
Yeah, we had to show up with beer and chocolate. So, but it was super interesting because they all the companies were kind of the same age, that had the same, you know, ballpark revenue, same ballpark number of employees, but they naturally founded two groups. And one of these groups is scaling at more, you know, a pretty significant clip, and the others are just kind of hanging out. And so then we started to look at what were the differences between these two. And it turns out that entrepreneurs who are in an industry with a net profit margin of 20% or more were significantly more likely to be scaling. In fact, there was a 26 percentage point difference between the two, right? So it's pretty significant. And it totally makes common sense, right? Like if you're in an industry that's like large, growing, highly profitable, like that's a nice wave to be riding, and it's super easy. It's not super easy, but it's easier to, you know, get cash flow going to grow your business. But like, I've yet to meet an entrepreneur who's like, oh, I've got this great idea. I really am wanting to, you know, launch into this industry because it's got a high profit margin. Like, no, like entrepreneurs are always thinking like, I really like this product that I have. I'm super excited about this product. So they don't often think about the industry as well. But that's a really important thing once it gets to the scaling phase. Like you've got to be in alignment where the company's going. It's got to be a big, growing, profitable market segment to be going after. So that's kind of the second criteria that we look at to think about, is this company ready to scale? Mm-hmm. Then the other ones kind of quickly, the third one is you kind of have to, you know, have a business model that works, right? Like, you know, it doesn't have to be profitable right now, but you've got to have, you know, at steady state, a plan of how it's going to be, or realistic expectation that's going to have a positive gross margin. You know, some of the initiatives I work with have no path to figure out how they're actually going to make money. Like you have to have a plan that, you know, either today you're making money or there's a clear plan once some economies of scale kick in that you'll be making money. Mm-hmm. The fourth thing is that the team needs to be able to repeatedly sell, produce, and deliver the product. You know, some teams I see, you know, they're still in the lean startup early phases where they're, you know, personally delivering the product or, you know, manually making it in the back of an office. Or, you know, one entrepreneur I worked with, he's very, very smart, and he built the first version, then he gave it to his brother, who then built the entire product. It's a hardware and software combination, but you know, it's kind of buggy, right? Like, and that's going to be a problem if you scale. So you've kind of got to be able to, you know, produce, sell, and deliver the product. That engine has to be kind of be in place at least a little bit. The fifth one is you got to have some organizational maturity. Like you got to have a full-time team in place. You got to have a CEO in place. You got to know what the metrics are that are going to drive your business. Those got to be identified and being tracked, right? Like you got to kind of know how your business is going to make money and what's important to your business. And then finally, the sixth one is kind of what you mentioned before, traction. Like looking at the, you know, it should have some growing traction in terms of that whole funnel from acquisition to referral. So it's got to kind of start to be picking up before then, you know, you can think about, can I really scale this?
And there it can be kind of important, especially if you're early stage, to show those metrics according to a cohort analysis. So you're not just doing an average, because as you're doing cohort analysis, you can actually show improvements that you can't do when you're doing typical traditional Google Analytics types of averages, because it's a
right. Specialized
program, right? So I think that's something that a lot of people in the corporate world don't understand, cohort analysis, because they don't do that in that way.
Oh, it's so powerful, because once you make a change and you can track, like, see where it goes and see the influence through time, and people have it and don't have it. You can totally see that with cohorts.
That's the thing, because when we're doing startups, new entrepreneurial ventures, we are making changes all the time. We're doing experiments all the time. So we need to see how those experiments affect the people coming in during that batch and not the ones previously who already converted.
So through the entire scaling process, you're going to want to continue to do that. Like it's at all stages, it's super important.
Absolutely. And I totally agree with you on the path to profitability. It's always nice to see. The only exception I can think of would be perhaps when you're building a network model where you are scaling a network, and as the network becomes bigger, it grows in value. And then you can kind of try and figure out, as long as you have active, engaged users who are also perhaps referring, and the network is growing in that sense at the kind of low marginal costs. You might argue that we can put more money into this, even if we don't know exactly how we're going to cash out at this very moment.
Right.
I can think of Facebook and Twitter, Spotify, a lot of these business models at the beginning weren't sure how to make money, but they were still raising a lot of money to grow quickly because they saw the value in the network that they were building.
It's funny. So I'm from Silicon Valley, and I always joke that Silicon Valley investors are people making decisions about whether to invest in a corporate or a startup initiative. They're much more likely to invest on a dream. Like, it's going to be one day it's going to be great, and these network effects are going to kick in. I find in Europe, people are much more likely to want to invest on cash flow.
You're right. They're much more risk averse, I'd say. Less of thinking these big visions, but it's changing a little bit, especially in Stockholm here, where I'm from. It's interesting.
Yeah.
I even heard actually another thing about scaling, something that can be a little bit difficult, and maybe it's outside of the startup or even the corporate fear of influence. And it's, of course, politicians trying to lower the barriers, because we had a discussion here in Stockholm in Sweden now where Spotify was more or less threatening to move the headquarters if the politicians didn't make it possible to provide affordable housing, because they want to, of course, hire the best talent they can in terms of engineers and developers, and even if they can find them, they have no place to live.
That is a big challenge.
Yeah, you can't put them up in hotels for a year. No one wants to live in a hotel for a year. So this is an issue. We just don't have a flexible rental market here in Stockholm.
That's tough.
Yeah, it is. Yes.
So it's tough to scale when you can't, onboard. You have to be able to onboard people quickly. And if you can't, if your engineers don't have a place to live, they're not coding, they're looking for housing.
Yes, exactly. And that worries them, and they can't focus and stuff. Yeah. Like that. So, no, but that's always an issue.